Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Jim Stein, your host for New Books in Math, a channel of the New Books Network. Our guest today is Jason Rosenhaus, author of Games for Your Mind. This book is about a panoply of logic puzzles. You'll find Mastermind and Sudoku discussed early on, and then you'll be hit with an incredible array of some of the most intriguing logic puzzles that have ever been devised. Some will be familiar to you, but some will almost certainly be brain teasers you've never heard of. It's absolutely amazing what a truly deep field grew from recreational pastimes, and this book is an absolute treasure trove of stuff you can't help thinking about. If you like logic, you're certain to be sucked in, but you'll enjoy the ride. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Jason, what motivated you to write this book?
Part of it was just that I've always loved logic puzzles from the time really going back to middle school when I actually discovered Raymond Smullyan's books. And I really enjoyed his knight and knave puzzles, puzzles where knights always tell the truth and knaves always lie. So logic puzzles have always been an interest of mine. And I just thought it would make it an interesting book. Talk a little bit about what Raymond Smullyan did, talk a little bit about what Lewis Carroll did, and then talk about my own very minor contribution where I discuss logic puzzles related to non-classical logics, which I thought might be fun. So that was the original genesis. I just thought it would make it kind of a fun, short book. I have to admit, though, once I started writing it, it became a much bigger project than I realized. And as you mentioned in your introduction, that I came to realize that a lot of these recreational logic puzzles also impinge on big questions in philosophy and mathematics, and it became really hard to separate what's a logic puzzle, what's a fun recreational thing, and what's an actually like a serious question that professionals would worry about.
Well, that's an excellent segue into my first question. What is the difference between the everyday perception of logic, how mathematicians perceive logic, and how philosophers perceive logic?
Yeah, so that's a pretty deep question, because one of the things I mentioned in the book is that, in day-to-day life, logic never really seems all that difficult. If you say something like, all cats are mammals and all mammals are animals. Anyone figures out that that means all cats are animals. And, basic logic like that you do all the time. I use an example in the book where I say, if you misplace your keys and you look for them by retracing your steps throughout the day, you're basically doing a logical argument. You're saying, well, I know when I had the keys last, and I know I visited certain places. I could only have left the keys at some place that I actually was. So I'll go revisit those places. And you don't even think of that as doing logic. I mean, that's so obvious and so simple. So in everyday life, just figuring out kind of what follows from what never seems that complicated. But it becomes very complicated when you actually try to write down rules to this effect. Right, logic is related to language. And somehow the rules of logic have to do with the way we use language. And that's where the philosophers get involved, where they try to figure out, what are the principles of reasoning and how do they get expressed, in what we call natural language, English, French, German, that kind of language. So that's kind of the philosophical interest in it. Now, mathematicians, we always use logic, just in our day-to-day life. Anytime you do a mathematical proof, of course, you're using deductive logic to do that. But for most of its history, logic was not an object of study for mathematicians specifically. In other words, we use logic, but we didn't actually, you know, study logic for its own sake. Although that started changing around the turn of the last century, you know, partly over concerns about the logical foundations of mathematics and certain things like that. And then more recently, the computer scientists have got involved, you know, in it. And different systems of logic can be useful in computer science for different purposes. For example, one issue nowadays is that computers increasingly are expected to deal with very large data sets where the data might be contradictory in some way, like more recently added data might contradict earlier data. And you don't want the computer to go to pieces like something out of Star Trek when that happens. So anyway, so the upshot is that you have all these different aspects to it. The philosophers have their interest, the mathematicians have theirs, computer scientists have a third, and then there's just the day-to-day practice of logic, which never really seems all that complicated at all. So anyway, I hope that answers your question. That might have been a little rambling.
That's okay. Ramble as much as you like. It's basically what you feel like saying. But why do you think logic puzzles such as Sudoku enjoy such widespread popularity?
I think it's just that logic is fun. When you come right down to it, that's like Sudoku puzzles are a good example. I use that as an example of a straightforward logic puzzle, even though it's not really presented that way. That's exactly what it is, right? I mean, you're given the initial clues in your 9x9 square, and your job is to infer the logical consequences of those clues. And I think anyone who has ever done a Sudoku puzzle, and, you know, lots of people do Sudoku who would never, say, read a math textbook or something like that. But you know just how satisfying it is. You know, when you figure out, you look at some cell and you say, okay, there's a 1, 2, 3 in the column and a 4, 5, 6 in the row. And then there's a 7, 8 in the box. Ah, it has to be a 9. And you really feel good about yourself when you do that. And which is funny. I mean, it's the most pointless thing. And yet you really feel like you've accomplished something. So at heart, I think that's what it is. In fact, I wouldn't even restrict this to logic. I would say this is true of mathematics in general, where you have this phenomenon where, you know, most people will tell you with great enthusiasm about how much they hate math. And yet often those same people will enjoy a clever brain teaser or a little puzzle, right? So it's not really the math or the logic that people don't like. I think it's the way it's presented in classes is what's unappealing.
Yeah, and they sure enjoyed, you know, everybody enjoyed Sherlock Holmes and Hercule Poirot and the classic logical detectives. And, the idea of logic pervades that as well.
Yeah, and in fact, the final chapter in the book is all about that. I call them literary logic puzzles.
Yeah, I know, I got it.
that particular chapter, I don't know where maybe we're, that's actually the end of the book. But I'll just mention, though, that part of my own interest in logic. I mentioned that I like logic puzzles as a kid. My father was always reading classic detective stories like this, and he always had all these old paperbacks stacked up around the house. And there was just something when I remember when I kind of like got around like later middle school, when I got to the point where I was old enough to read books like that and really understand them. I remember just how much fun it was that these detectives like Hercule Poirot and Sherlock Holmes or Ellery Queen, they're basically superheroes. And their superpower is their ability to use logic so skillfully, and it was just it's just so much fun watching them get the bad guy just by sheer brain power and applying logic.
That's a very interesting way to put it. I never thought of them as superheroes. That's clever.
Well, thank you.
Okay, I saw the classic five houses problem when I was young, and perhaps you could describe it and maybe one or two of the other logic puzzles that have endured.
Yeah, okay, so the five houses puzzle, that's actually been attributed to Albert Einstein, although apparently that's apocryphal. You can find on websites somewhere that says this is Albert Einstein invented this. I don't think that's true, although he certainly might have. But basically, what the puzzle actually is, it's a list of usually like 15 to 17 facts. And the idea is that you're supposed to imagine five houses in a line, and five different people live in the houses, and they have five different nationalities and five different professions, and prefer five different beverages, and they each have a different pet. And the list of facts say things like, I guess each has a different color too. And you say things like, the person in the blue house is not the teacher. And you have a list of facts like that. And so this is a very famous puzzle. It exists in numerous different forms. For me, when I encountered this puzzle, I was literally 6 years old when I encountered this. And of course it was way beyond me at that point. I couldn't have handled it. But it showed up in a book of puzzles that was not intended for adults. It was it had little word search puzzles that I always liked as a kid. And then all of a sudden, spang in the middle of the book is this big book. It was printed on paper that you were supposed to write on. And then spang in the middle of the book is this list of 17 facts. And I didn't know what to do with that. But the way it was phrased in the version that I saw was there was a specific question you were supposed to answer. And the question was, who owns the monkey? And with a big picture, with a big cartoon monkey at the bottom of the page. And I thought that was just the funniest thing, the idea of somebody owning a monkey. So that's another one, actually. A lot of my early development here came from my father, who always liked these puzzles. I showed it to him. And as I said, at age six, I didn't know what to do with that. And I remember my father getting a pad of paper and just furrowing his brow and writing and scribbling on the pad. And then about 45 minutes later, he said, the Spaniard owns the monkey. And it looked like a magic trick to me. But anyway, yeah, so that's a very famous one. That's actually quite a difficult puzzle. Logic puzzles in various forms have existed for a long time. I mentioned Raymond Smullyan's Knights and Knaves puzzles, where you have knights only make true statements and knaves always lie. But actually, puzzles about liars and truth tellers, they go back quite a ways. The oldest specific one that I mentioned in the book was from the 1930s. And was due to a philosopher named Nelson Goodman, who was actually a very famous philosopher and logician. I believe he was a professor at Harvard for most of his career. But anyway, he published a short puzzle. I think it would be too difficult to try to discuss the specific puzzle here. But suffice it to say, it was a puzzle of the liar and truth teller sort. And in his memoirs, in his collected papers later, he mentioned that little puzzle that he published in some local newspaper received more replies and more mail than any of his professional papers ever did.
In fact, probably the sum total of any of his professional papers, because I've had that experience myself.
Yeah, I can sympathize with it.
Yeah. Anyway, there's another person whom we associate with logic puzzles that it's pretty astounding to me that we did, namely Lewis Carroll. We think of him as the author of Alice in Wonderland, but who was he and what did he do that was relevant to your book?
Yeah, so that's an interesting story in its own right. That's one whole major section of the book is about Lewis Carroll. Now, of course, as you mentioned, Lewis Carroll is famous for having written Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass and various works of poetry as well. But he was a very interesting person. Now, Lewis Carroll, probably most people listening to this know that was a pen name that he used. His real name was Charles Dodson. And as Charles Dodson, he was a reasonably well-known mathematician. You probably wouldn't rank him among the absolute greats or anything that, but he was certainly a very competent mathematician who did a lot of very pioneering things. In fact, there's a very funny story about him where some prominent person in British society, having read Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, told Lewis Carroll how impressed she was with these books and asked him to send her a copy of his next book. Well, his next book was A Treatise on the Theory of Determinants.
I heard that was Queen Victoria.
Oh, was that? Oh, okay. I didn't even hear that part. Okay. So yeah, I mean, that's such a good story. It really should be true.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Lewis Carroll was well known as a mathematician. He even had a third line where he was well known as a photographer. Now, of course, this was in the mid to late 1800s when photography was a lot more difficult than it is now. But that was their line. He was very pioneering there. Yeah, he did a pioneer work in voting theory, the mathematical theory of voting. So there you go. He had this kind of dual existence where he was known as a mathematician, but also known as the author of these books. Now, it's interesting. Later in his life, he published two books on logic. One was called The Game of Logic, which was literally a collection of logic puzzles. I'll say a word about that in a moment. And then later, he wrote a more serious book called Symbolic Logic. And that was intended, the book that was actually published was intended to be the first of a three-volume set. Lewis Carroll died before the second two volumes could be published, but a nearly complete manuscript of the second volume was later discovered and published in the 1970s. What makes these works so interesting was that, first of all, Lewis Carroll published these works under the Lewis Carroll name, right? In other words, like he usually published his professional work in mathematics under the Dodson name, and then his children's literature was under Lewis Carroll. But he saw his work in logic as being directed to a very general audience. And in fact, the first book, The Game of Logic, was specifically directed at children, that these are supposed to be fun little puzzles to teach children logic. Now, the kind of puzzles he was doing were fundamentally different from the kind of puzzles I've mentioned to this point. He wasn't doing liar and truth teller type puzzles. His puzzles were based on so-called Aristotelian logic, which has to do with syllogisms of the sort that I mentioned a bit ago. Like if I say
the cats and cats animals, mammals, yeah,
and, yeah, that's a standard Aristotelian syllogism. And his puzzles were wonderfully inventive for illustrating how to derive the correct conclusion from syllogisms like that. And as I discussed in the book, he had a whole game. You know, he had a little game board, and you move little counters on the board. And it was really very clever what he did. And it was just just to wrap this up in relation to what I discussed in the book, the relevance is that on the one hand, he saw this as fun puzzles that could appeal to children. But at the same time, he saw it as a contribution to scholarship. And it's just a perfect illustration of what I'm talking about. It's very hard to draw the line between when is it recreational math and when is it serious scholarship.
Yeah, one of the things that your book did is it enriched my vocabulary with a couple of words, one of which was, I'm not sure that I'm pronouncing this correctly, sorite. Am I? S-O-R-I-T-E? Or don't you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's more common to refer to it in the plural, right? Sorites.
Okay. Yeah. Oh,
I assume the singular is sorites.
Okay, okay. Anyway, what type of puzzles are these?
So sorites, comes from the Greek word for heap. And in fact, there's something in logic called the sorites paradox, which is actually separate from, I think, what we're talking about here. In the context of Lewis Carroll's puzzles, a sorites puzzle was basically just a long list of these categorical statements. And when I say categorical statements, I mean statements like all cats are mammals or no fish are mammals.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing we mean when we talk about categorical statements. And Aristotelian logic was all about what conclusion you can draw from categorical statements like this. So I mentioned the game of logic a minute ago. Lewis Carroll in that book usually would give two categorical statements, and they would be deliberately very humorous statements like no oysters can dance the jig. You know, that's the kind of thing Lewis Carroll would do. But then in his other book, Symbolic Logic, he would consider much more elaborate puzzles where you might have, three or four or five. And he really went to town. He would have puzzles with like 40 different categorical statements. And you would try to have to deduce what follows from all of this.
Yeah, if you've got a weekend to work on it, sure.
Carroll really seemed into this. But here again, there was a serious point underlying this, which was that, a serious question for professional logicians at that time was precisely this question. You have a bunch of categorical statements. Is there some sort of formal procedure that you can do, some sort of algorithm that will allow you to just mechanically figure out what follows? And Lewis Carroll made an interesting contribution to that, where he showed basically that you could take certain categorical statements, translate them into a symbolic language, and then by making various marks and underscorings, you could actually get the conclusions to sort of appear. And that was sort of the serious scholarly point underlying a lot of these puzzles. You can read his puzzles just as fun, humorous things, but there really was a serious point to underlying it.
I'm just curious if you have at hand one of the short Carroll puzzles that has amusing touches to it that you might be able to read to give the audience a taste for what they were. And if you don't, we'll move on to the next topic.
Well, I do have the book actually in front of me at the moment.
By an amazing coincidence.
Yeah, so like here is one puzzle that involved three statements.
Perfect.
Okay. So the first statement was no ducks waltz. Okay. Then the second statement was no officers ever decline to waltz. And then the third statement is all my poultry are ducks. And
wonderful.
You have to try to figure out what follows from that.
Yeah. Yeah. Just wonderful.
Yeah. Now it's funny, right? I have that puzzle there. I have to admit, I don't have the solution handy.
Oh, no, we don't want that, because what we want is we want the audience to think about it and then go out and buy your book, because there's a lot of stuff in it. Anyway,
okay. The solution is actually on page 71.
Okay. Carroll also made puzzle contributions to the journal Mind. What did Bertrand Russell have to say about these contributions?
Right. Okay. So that's another interesting aspect of this, right? Because Mind, M-I-N-D, Mind, that's an academic journal. The kind of thing that professional philosophers publish in. It actually still exists today. That journal is one of the more prominent philosophy journals. but even the late 1800s, it already existed. And as I said, this was not generally a forum for fun, humorous things. These were very serious scholars who would publish their work there. But Lewis Carroll actually published two papers there, two very short papers. But they became surprisingly influential. Now, both of them, on the one hand, they related to serious philosophical issues. Both of them were in some way related to the correct interpretation of if-then statements, conditional statements. And that can be a surprisingly difficult subject in its own right. What, you know, if you say something like if P, then Q, and you know that you know P is true and Q is false or something like that, you know, what do you conclude about the whole statement? So on the one hand, he wrote these scholarly papers. But on the other hand, in true Lewis Carroll fashion, he wrote them in the form of humorous dialogues with funny characters and a whole storyline. And so that's another illustration where on the one hand, he had a serious scholarly point to make. On the other hand, he wrote it as though it were a fun dialogue. I mean, I literally have never seen any other scholarly paper written like this. I wish more scholars would write like this. It would make their work more interesting.
Yeah, it'd be a whole lot more entertaining, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think nowadays, if you dare have some fun, with your research, you'll be deemed unserious, for that reason alone. The issue, I think we probably don't want to get too far into the weeds about what the specific issues were. But of course, Bertrand Russell came along. He kind of rose to prominence in the late 1800s, early 1900s, one of the real pioneers in mathematical logic. And he was impressed actually with Carroll's papers. He in the sense that he thought they raised interesting and important issues that had to be resolved. Russell was he was a little bit mixed about Carroll. That he thought Carroll's puzzles were very ingenious, and he thought those two papers were quite interesting. But he also commented that Lewis Carroll was sort of the he kind of came right on the cusp of a major change in logic, that prior to Carroll, Aristotelian logic was really the main focus of what logic was all about. And then right around the time that Carroll was writing, he kind of had the rug pulled out from under him. And there was the shift to mathematical logic that people like Bertrand Russell and others like Frege and Whitehead were very instrumental in. So the whole landscape of logic changed shortly after Carroll did his work. Carroll died shortly after he wrote his works on logic. They were some of the last things he did. So Bertrand Russell, who could be pretty scathing towards people. I mean, you should read his remarks about Euclid. He was very unimpressed with Euclid. but he had some nice things to say about Carroll and thought his two papers and mine actually raised very interesting subtle issues that he himself, Russell, tried to address in some of his own writing.
Yeah, what is the difference between Aristotelian logic, which you've sort of alluded to when, we think of it syllogisms, and propositional logic?
Right. So I guess the best way to put it is that Aristotelian logic is a subset of propositional logic. So, what we usually call propositional logic, you can think of that as a big generalization of what Aristotle was doing. So Aristotle had a very limited interest. I mean, and this literally goes back to Aristotle. You can read his works on logic. And Aristotle's idea was that, one of his works was called The Prior Analytics, where the idea was that he was trying to write down basically rules for what follows from what. But that system of logic that he wrote was part of a whole metaphysical system about human reasoning and how we define things and the apprehend objects out there in the world, and then we draw distinctions among the objects. No fish are mammals, all cats are mammals, and we express them with categorical statements. And then the third part of it is that you reason from lists of these categorical statements. Okay, propositional logic basically says, well, there are other kinds of statements out there that impose logical burdens on people. For example, if I say if P then Q, if I say if it rains then I'll go to the movies, and then it does rain. Then that implies that I will go to the movies, right? In other words, there are statements other than categorical statements that impose logical burdens on people. If you say P and Q, that should imply that P and Q are both true individually, for example. Or if you say something like P or Q, and then you find out that P is false, right? That should imply that Q is true. So that's kind of the relationship there, is that Aristotle had a very limited idea of what logic was. And the reason he had that limited idea was that it really fit into his broader metaphysical program that he was doing. Propositional logic is sort of this big extension where you just view categorical statements as one example of propositions, but there are many others as well. And the basic principles of propositional logic, I mean, that too goes back to the ancient Greeks. You know, that got developed all through the Middle Ages, and a lot of medieval logicians had their say. And then that really didn't change right up until the 1800s, until people like George Boole introduced mathematical formalism, you know, into logic. And that eventually led to mathematical logic.
Yeah, does propositional logic have something to do with Gödel's incompleteness theorems?
In a sense. So Gödel's incompleteness theorems are considered like one of the supreme achievements of mathematical logic. The idea is that, you know, when we talk about mathematical logic, what we're really talking about is something called a formal system. And, you know, formal systems, the idea is that it's almost like, let's see, like probably a good example of a formal system would be like the rules of chess, right? When you learn how to play chess, you know, you learn things like the bishop moves on diagonals, the rook moves, up and down and side to side, the king moves one square at a time, and these are rules laid down in the game. And if you ask a question like, well, what is a king, right? Or what is a bishop, or what is a rook? You don't really know how to answer that, right? It's sort of the wrong question, right? It's not what is a king, right? It's what role does it play in the game, right? This is what it does in the game. And that's essentially what mathematicians do when you have a formal axiomatic system that takes something like Euclid's geometry. He talks about points and lines, and he says things like, for any two points, there's a line joining them. Nowadays we would just say points and lines are just undefined objects. Like, I don't know what points are. I don't know what lines are. But I do know that if you give me any two points, there's a line joining them. And that's the idea, that we think of them as purely formal objects, even if we have some real life instantiation of them in mind. When we're actually doing geometry, they're just formal objects that satisfy certain rules. And of course, mathematicians get very interested in these formal systems because you like to have, when you're proving theorems, you like to know what the minimal logical foundation is, for whatever you're doing, right? What are my minimal commitments to get the theorems that I want? So that's roughly what mathematical logic is. Mathematical logic is you're studying formal systems as objects in their own right. And Gödel's theorems were certain deep statements about the nature of formal systems. And we can actually explain, essentially at least the so-called first incompleteness theorem. We can certainly explain in general terms what that is. The idea is that you have a concept of provability, right? If you have a formal system, there are certain things that can be proved within that system. And then separately from that, there's a notion of what's true in that system. And that would be something like, if you have a model that instantiates those axioms, what would be true in that model? So you have truth on the one hand and provability on the other. And the going thinking at the time was that truth and provability are essentially the same thing. If something is true in the system, then there must be a proof within the system. And if you can prove something within the system, then the thing you prove must be true. And that seems very commonsensical. But Gödel's theorems were basically all about showing, that actually is not correct. That if you have any reasonably powerful formal system, then it must be true that there are statements in the system that are true but cannot be proved. Either that or the system is inconsistent. Like, you could actually prove something that's false. Those are your options. And this was quite surprising when Gödel did this in the early 30s. So there you go. So it's not specifically propositional logic, but it's related to it in some way.
Yeah, it sort of it stunned me that Gödel's results applied to arithmetic, and you think of arithmetic as being so basic, and it's so obvious. And yet there are some, what Gödel showed is there are really deep and complex problems involved with arithmetic and its axiomatization.
And that's really well put. And since we're talking about logic, I can give another example of that, which is Russell's paradox. Bertrand Russell, same Russell as before, so Russell's paradox was the one about sets, where you say you imagine the set of all sets that are not elements of themselves. Right, like some sets are elements of themselves. Like, the set of all abstract ideas is an abstract idea. I love that example. Or the set of all things that are not watermelons, right, is itself not a watermelon. So some sets answer to their own descriptions. Of course, most sets don't. Right, the set of all red things is not itself red.
Right.
So it feels meaningful to say, I'll define a set whose elements are the sets that are not elements of themselves. And probably, I'll bet probably people listening to this probably know Russell's paradox. and no, you get led into trouble. And the thing that always struck me about Russell's paradox is that, you know, the notions that it's based on are so basic and so fundamental. You're just giving a, you know, a defining characteristic of a set. Like, what could go wrong with that? And yet you're already in deep waters. And I appreciate what you said about Gödel, which is the same thing, right? I made a reference to any sufficiently strong axiom system. Sufficiently strong just means powerful enough to be able to do basic arithmetic within. And yeah, and it's just astonishing in math and in logic and in philosophy. You know, seemingly the simplest things lead you into very deep waters very quickly.
Yeah. Anyway, the next chapter of your book is entitled Question Puzzles. Perhaps you could start us off with one and analyze it. Or just start us off with one if the analysis is long.
Yeah. So you know, roughly what I mean by question puzzles is, puzzles where your job is to ask a question that elicits a meaningful answer, even if you don't know whether the person you're talking to is lying or telling the truth. And this is a whole genre in its own right. And there's one among the question puzzles. There's one that's really so famous and I think just so ingenious that it has a pride of place in any discussion of this subject. It's sometimes referred to as the heaven hell puzzle.
Because
in the original version it's very dramatic. And the idea is you're in a room with two doors, and one of them is the door to heaven, and one of them is the door to hell. And they're identical doors. You don't know which is which. I think we'll assume that you want to find the door to heaven. And and there are two people in the room, and one of them always lies, and one of them always tells the truth. And you can assume that these people know which door is which. But of course, they'll answer any question you ask them in a manner consistent with their nature. And you don't know who's who, right? So you could go up to one of them and say, and point to one of the doors and say, "Hey, is that the door to heaven?" But you won't know how to interpret the answer, right? If it's the truth teller, his answer will be truthful. And if he's the liar, his answer will be false. But you don't know who you're talking to, right? So any simple question you would ask like that just isn't going to get you very far, because you won't know how to interpret the answer. So the problem is, what one question can you ask of one of the guards? You can ask one question of one of the guards, and then based on that answer, you have to make your decision. So the puzzle is, what should you ask? And as I said, the key is that it has to be a question where, regardless of whether you're talking to the liar or the truth teller, you know how to interpret the answer. And this is another one that I heard as a kid. I think this one I heard in middle school. I think I learned this one in school. And I was just amazed by it, because it just sounds so impossible. If you've never heard this puzzle before, it just sounds so impossible. What could you possibly ask that would be meaningful? But there really is a solution. And the solution is to go up to either one of the guards and you say, if I asked the other guard which one is the door to heaven, right, which door would he point to? Okay, let me say that again. You go up to one of the guards and you say, if I asked the other guard which one is the door to heaven, which one would he point to? And now the reasoning actually goes through, the reasoning isn't too bad, right? If you're talking to the truthful guard, right, well, then he'll say, well, the liar would point to the wrong door, right? If you were actually talking to the liar, he would point to the wrong door. So the truth teller knows that the liar would do that, and he'll then point to the wrong door. He'll point to the door to hell. Okay, but suppose you're talking to the liar. Well, the liar knows that the truth teller will point to the correct door, but then he'll lie about it and point to the wrong door, right? So it's almost like a double negative, right? You're kind of tricking them, into telling the right door. So the upshot is, whatever door the guard points to, you do the other one. And that will be the correct thing to do, regardless of whether you're talking to the liar or the truth teller. And that's what that chapter is all about. There are many variations on a theme. And it's just, kind of surprising how ingenious you can be about this.
Yeah. Do you happen to know offhand what the provenance of this puzzle is?
Of the heaven hell puzzle?
Yeah.
You know, I actually don't. I think this is one of those puzzles that has been around for so long, in various forms, that I don't know if anyone knows the origin of it. As I recall, I don't even give a specific reference for it. Like, I think that puzzle is now so famous at this point that you don't even have to give a specific reference of where you got the puzzle.
Okay,
from.
I was just sort of curious. I mean, I don't know. You know, my feeling is that something like that might have originated in the Middle Ages. You know, Aquinas or somebody like that might have thought about it.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. I must say I did not find any specific reference to it when I was doing my research.
Okay.
But it certainly could have been there somewhere.
Okay. You've discussed various types of logic, but there are two that that come sort of at the end of your book, and one of them are classical logic and non-classical logic. And I realize this is this is a big ask, but could you sort of explain what the two are and how they differ?
We can certainly give the gist of it, without too much trouble.
Sure.
Classical logic is basically what any normal person would think of when you say logic, right? In fact, I think, as I mentioned in the book, that if you're not immersed in this subject, the very idea that you need an adjective in front of the word logic to clarify what kind of logic you're dealing with, that's going to sound very weird. And in fact, the word logics, plural, that's a word you'll see in the philosophical literature. They'll talk about different kinds of logics. The spell checker on my computer did not recognize that as a word. Insists it's not a word. Logics.
Logics. Okay.
Yeah, logics plural with an S at the end. So classical logic is just the normal sort of logic that it's the sort of logic that you know instinctively. Like, remember when I said at the start that everyone, in day to day life, no one ever really seems to have all that much trouble with logic. That's basically classical logic that you're doing. And in slightly more formal, in a slightly more formal presentation, you get the system of logic that mathematicians use, in their work. And there are certain fundamental principles that underlie classical logic. Principles that, again, seem so natural and so obvious that you would just be amazed that anyone would question them. One of them, for example, is the idea that there are exactly two truth values, right? Every statement is either true or it's false, and that's it. There's no middle ground. There's no neither true nor false. There's no both true or false. Nothing like that. And then you have principles like the law of non-contradiction, right? If you have a statement P and then it's contradiction not P, those can't both be true at the same time. And you have these certain basic fundamental principles. Well, non-classical logic is then any system of logic that rejects one of those basic principles. So, for example, there's something called fuzzy logic, where instead of truth being a matter of discrete values, where you say true or false, those are the only issues. Fuzzy logic might say something like, "Well, no, truth is a continuum, right? You have absolute falsity, which we might represent with zero at one end, and then absolute truth, which we would represent with one at the other. But then a truth value is just some number, in that interval that you assign to it." And there might be situations where this is useful. You could also countenance like three-valued logic or four-valued logic, where maybe you do want to allow an option like neither true nor false. In other words, maybe you want to say all statements are either true or false or neither true nor false. Maybe you want to allow that. Certainly in everyday language, sometimes you have statements that are not unambiguously true or unambiguously false. Maybe you don't want to assign the truth value. Or maybe you do want to allow fuzzy truth. Like you might say something like maybe you have someone who's 13 years old, and you say, that person is a child. Well, in some ways they're like a child, and in some ways they're not like a child, right? So maybe you don't want to be dogmatic about it. So, and that very roughly is the distinction. Even things like the law of non-contradiction, you can find, very high-powered books by very impressive philosophers saying that maybe the law of non-contradiction is not all it's cracked up to be, right? Maybe we don't really need that. And that very roughly is the distinction. That classical logic is the sort of normal logic that most people would know. And then non-classical logic is where you reject one of those fundamental principles. And just like you can have different systems of geometry, right? You have Euclid's system, which seems very natural and very intuitive, but there are also non-Euclidean systems that are very useful in certain contexts. Well, increasingly, philosophers see systems of logic that way. Classical logic is a perfectly good system and it has its uses, right? But maybe there are other systems that might be useful in other contexts.
One of the things that you discussed is the fact that multivalent logics can affect knight-knave puzzles where you no longer have the knights are exclusively truth-tellers and the knaves are exclusively liars.
Yeah, so this was kind of my own little contribution to this this genre, if I may, where we started, as you asked me about the genesis of the book. Part of it was that somehow I just got curious about non-classical logics. Not for any really specific professional reason, just for whatever reason it caught my attention. And I thought, just like Carroll and Smullyan use logic puzzles to illustrate ideas in logic, it might be fun to devise knight and knave style puzzles, but in the context of non-classical logics. So if you're going to do that, though, you have to kind of change the rules a little bit, right? Because the old rules are that knights always tell the truth and knaves always lie. So I came up with this idea that people cycle back and forth between being a knight and knave. They're a knight for a while, and then they enter a transitional phase, and then they merge at the other end of knaves. And I looked at what the logical consequences of that were. When they're in their knight phase, they only make true statements. When they're in their knave phase, they only make false statements. And when they're in their transitional phase, maybe they only make statements of a third truth value. Maybe we allow that neutral third value, the neither true nor false. So that, as I said, that's my own little original contribution to this. And I hope if I was successful, I managed to illustrate a few issues that arise in non-classical logic using the medium of knight and knave puzzles.
Yeah, well, that's sort of like what Carroll did.
Yeah, and that was my inspiration. And Smullyan did the same thing, by the way. We kind of glossed over it earlier, but Smullyan had these fun knight and knave puzzles, and you have these funny characters making humorous dialogues. But some of his puzzles were specifically meant to illustrate Gödel's theorems, and he was able to take the main ideas of Gödel's theorems and translate them into clever puzzles. And like most people, you hand them a logic textbook and say, "Go read the section on Gödel's theorems." Well, they're not really going to get very far on that. But Smullyan's puzzles illustrate all of the main ideas in a form that are much more fun and engaging. And here again, this is really one of the big themes of the book. And kind of cycling back to where we started, it's one of the reasons the book ended up being a lot longer and a lot more complicated than I originally intended it to be. Because on the one hand, I was talking about fun puzzles, but on the other hand, it kept leading into scholarly questions. And puzzles can just be a fun way of introducing technical issues. In other words, as I just said, right? If you hand someone a textbook, most people are just not going to be able to read that. But you present the same ideas in the form of a puzzle, and then suddenly it's very engaging.
You mentioned something called the hardest logic puzzle ever. I know that I've seen Sudoku, which says this is the hardest Sudoku. And the idea of the hardest logic puzzle ever seems, it struck me that was a very, very bold statement to make. And could you tell us what it is and a little bit about its history?
Yeah, so that's a really fun one, the hardest logic puzzle ever. That's actually the longest chapter in the book. It's something like 40 pages in the book or something. And I ended up
well, it's a hard puzzle.
Yeah. Right. That chapter is called The Saga of the Hardest Logic Puzzle Ever. And it really is a saga. So what it is. So first of all, when I call it the hardest logic puzzle ever, that's not me calling it that. That is literally the name of the puzzle. Okay. You can type that phrase into Google. And probably the first thing that will come up was a very long Wikipedia article called The Hardest Logic Puzzle Ever. And it was created by George Boulos, who is a philosopher. I believe he was also at Harvard. Or no, he was at MIT. It was either Harvard or MIT. Anyway, one of those.
Someplace in Boston, yeah.
One of those hoity-toity schools. And basically the puzzle, I can actually tell you the puzzle reasonably quickly, although I don't think we'll be able to discuss the solution. The name is apt. But it's actually a very sophisticated example of one of the question puzzles that we were discussing earlier. So the puzzle is this. You imagine you have three gods. And once again, we're always very melodramatic in our puzzle statements here. So you have three gods. And one of them is named true. And one of them is named false. And one of them is named random. And the true god always answers truthfully. The false god always answers falsely. And the random god, just on the spur of the moment, decides whether he'll answer truthfully or falsely. And they'll only answer yes-no questions. That's a major rule. And when they answer your question, they will answer in a manner consistent with their nature. However, they will also answer in their own language. And in their language, the words for yes and no are da and ja, but you don't know which one means yes and which one means no.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the setup. I'll just repeat it one more time. One god always tells the truth. One god always lies. One god decides randomly whether to answer truthfully or falsely. They'll only answer yes, no questions, but they use their own language where the words for yes and no are da and ja. One of them means yes, one of them means no. You don't know which is which. Okay, so the actual puzzle is you confront the three gods, and you are allowed to ask up to three yes, no questions. And then based on their answers to those questions, you have to determine which god is which. Which one is true, which one is false, and which one is random. And then there are lots of little provisos that you have to keep in mind. Like it's okay, for example, your second question can depend on the answer to the first question. In other words, it's not that you have to present all three questions at once. You can ask one question to one of the gods, and then based on the answer, you can decide what the second question will be and who you'll direct it to. Okay, so anyway, that's the puzzle. And it really does sound kind of impossible.
Yeah, it does to me, sure.
Yeah, because I mean, it's like the heaven hell puzzle on steroids. And it's like, what on earth are you supposed to do here? Because you don't know what the words mean. And if you're talking to the random God, there's no hope. I mean, okay, so anyway, Boulos published this, not in a scholarly journal. It was like the Harvard Alumni Magazine or something like that. It was on some semi-popular venue like that. And he also presented his solution. And his solution was very intricate and required what we call biconditional statements. I mentioned conditional statements earlier where you say, if P, then Q. A biconditional statement is of the form P, if and only if Q. Like P and Q are logically equivalent. And his statement, it's fun to read his solution just as a work of poetry, right? Because the questions that he asks are these nested biconditionals where you say, is A the case if and only if B is the case if and only if C? And you can drive yourself crazy trying to analyze, all the different cases. But anyway, that was Boulos' solution. And it works. I mean, at one point I spent part of an afternoon, working out all the cases, like, oh my God, it really does work. But anyway, if you publish something called the hardest logic puzzle ever, and you present that to a room full of mathematicians, good luck with that. Because, every mathematician in the room is going to try to prove A, it's not that hard.
Yeah.
And then, and then B, come up with something harder.
Yeah, exactly.
And just to wrap this up, that's essentially the saga. After Boulos published his paper, other people published simpler solutions and then also increasingly more difficult variations on the puzzle. And it just goes on and on.
Well,
and,
of course. Anyway, what is a metapuzzle, and can you give us an example?
So what a metapuzzle is? This was another Smullyan invention, where the idea was, in a typical logic puzzle, right? You are given certain statements, you're given some information, and then you deduce the logical consequences of that information. Okay, in a metapuzzle. The information that you're given takes the form of knowing that based on the answers to certain questions, certain other puzzles either could or cannot be solved. And kind of the classic example of this, and this puzzle is not due to Smullyan, the classic example is, I think I'm, let me see if I can quickly look it up. It was the one about the kids playing baseball outside. I should have had this at my fingertips. Yeah. So the puzzle says, you say like Arnie and Beth were having a conversation, and Arnie says, what are the ages and years of your three children? And then Beth replies, well, the product of their ages is 36. And then Arnie shakes and says, no, that's not enough information. So then Beth says, well, the sum of their ages is the same as your son's age. And then Arnie says, no, that still isn't enough information. And then Beth says, well, my oldest child, and he's at least a year older than the others, has a wart on his left thumb. And from that information, what we learn is that Arnie now was able to deduce what the ages of the children were. So the idea is we don't really know, any of the information that Arnie knows, right? Like, we don't know the age of Arnie's son, and things of that sort. Right. And yet we know what Arnie was able to conclude or not conclude based on the information that he was given. And knowing what Arnie was able to conclude, that's enough for us to be able to conclude what the ages of the children were. And that very loosely is the idea of a meta puzzle. It's that, it's that the characters in the story have information that we don't have. But we do know what inferences the characters in the story were able to draw from the information they have. And knowing what conclusions they were able to draw, that allows us to answer the original question.
That's a nice example, and that's a nice way to phrase that particular concept. Okay, I guess the last question that I have to ask you about your book is, what are liar paradoxes, and can you give us an example?
Okay, yeah. So the liar paradox. This is a real classic. I have a chapter in the book on paradoxes. Paradoxes, I mentioned, they sort of straddle the line between puzzles and deep philosophical issues. Like we mentioned Russell's paradox a little bit ago. That was one of the set of all sets that are not elements of themselves. On the one hand, that's just very fun and recreational. Like I think, when you realize how weird that set is, you almost have to laugh or smile. It's like seeing a magic trick,
yep.
Right? Like, right? It's like you thought everything was fine, and then suddenly happened that seems to be impossible. On the other hand, something like Russell's paradox raises a very deep question, like what just went wrong, right? Because you give a predicate, to use the fancy term, and you're supposed to be able to talk about, you know, the set of elements that satisfy that predicate, and it really feels like there's nothing wrong with Russell's predicate, and yet it leads you to paradox. So the liar paradox is like that. And the liar paradox, at least in its classic form, you say something like, this sentence that I am uttering is false. Okay, and then the question is that
paradox of Epimenides, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, this goes back to antiquity in various forms. And probably people listening to this probably are familiar with this. But we can quickly say what the issue is, right? If I say, you know, this sentence that I am uttering is false, well, if you decide that the sentence is true, then what I am saying must really be the case, and that implies the sentence is false. But if instead I decide the sentence is false, then that implies that what I'm saying is not the case, in which case the sentence is actually true, right? So you get this paradox. And kind of the cool thing about the liar paradox is that it's really just nothing more than fundamental issues about truth and falsity, right? These very fundamental ideas like, you know, every statement is either true or false, but not both simultaneously. And then you're confronted, you know, with this sentence. And it's very mysterious. Like, what just went wrong here? And in fact, I mentioned a little bit ago that there are people who even question the law of non-contradiction. They say maybe that's not all it's cracked up to be. And there's even a system of logic called dialetheism, which is basically a system of logic based on the idea that some contradictions are actually true. And one of the reasons people study dialetheism is that it's a solution to the liar paradox. That if, you know, you take a statement like this sentence that I'm uttering is false, you just say it's simultaneously true and false, and then problem solved. And the fact that people will, you know, and the fact that people will, I'm being a little flippant about it, but the fact that people will countenance this, you know, shows you just how serious the issues were. Now, in the book, I have it's not a whole chapter, but I have a significant section on the liar paradox. I express a little skepticism about it because, you know, if you read the philosophical literature on it, you know, people write some very complicated papers about the liar paradox. And you have to wonder if do we really have to work that hard, you know, to get around this? Like, you know, I take the approach that I just say, you know, there's a distinction between propositions and sentences, right? Propositions are the things that are either true or false. And sentences, you know, declarative sentences are usually propositions, but not always. And this is just an instance of a sentence that doesn't really assert anything. And my feeling is, right, if you think about truth and falsity, you know, those concepts are really meant to apply to descriptions of the world, right? Like if I make a, you know, I say something like, the sweater that I'm wearing is blue, which happens to be true. You know, you take that sentence, you compare it to some aspect of reality, my sweater, and then you can decide if it's true or false. But if you just say something like this sentence that I'm uttering is false, I don't know what bit of reality I'm supposed to compare it to. At this point, like I don't even know what it means to assign a truth value. I feel like it doesn't really assert anything intelligible. And that very roughly is the line I take in the book. I just sort of feel like, you know, you can just sort of, you know, you can kind of ignore sentences like that and just pretend they're not there. Most philosophers are not satisfied with that explanation, though. They think you need something a little deeper. But it's just another example of something very simple, something you could explain the issues to a middle school student. The puzzle itself you can explain to a middle school student. And yet it leads you into these very fundamental questions about what truth and falsity actually are. Maybe that's a good place to wrap this up.
Yep. Jason, it's been an extremely enjoyable experience talking about this book. And I'd like to, I always conclude by asking how listeners can get in touch with you.
Well, I'm pretty easy to find. If you just type my name into Google, the first thing that comes up will be my personal webpage. At James Madison University, and you can certainly find my email address there. My email address, just for people listening, is rosenhjd, R-O-S-E-N-H-J-D, and then at jmu.edu. But I'm very easy to find online. As I said, just type my name into Google. I try to reply to all correspondents about the book. And I'll be happy to hear from readers.
Okay. Jason, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Take care.